Well, to begin with this morning, I'd like us to turn in Romans chapter 12, very briefly, before we get into our presentation. Can you hear me okay? In the back. Fine. Just to introduce our subject, we're going to read three verses in Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Paul, speaking to the Christians at Rome, says, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And to be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For I say, through the grace that is given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man this measure of faith." Paul told the Christians at Rome, as he tells us today, first off, that our bodies are to be presented as a sacrifice for God's service, to serve God. But he also goes on in verse 2 to make the statement that we should not be conformed to the world. And it said that we should not let the world squeeze us into its mold. Now this is what we're going to be talking about today in this presentation, and tonight we'll be going into it again. Is I'd like to show you this morning just how, in our society, in our day, we have, in a sense, been squeezed into the world's mold. Not necessarily of our own doing, but by the simple fact that we've been born here in North America, in this country, and we've been brought up, all of us, together in this society in which we find ourselves. It's very difficult to not be tainted, to not be conformed to the world's system, the world's way of looking at each other, the world's way of evaluating human worth. But he says that our minds have to be renewed. And so this morning and tonight, I'd like to show you how God would have our minds renewed. Now, we do not have to be conformed. We do not have to walk and judge and evaluate one another and our children and our peers according to the world's standard. Because everything around us gives us a false standard of measure. A false standard of measure whereby we measure our own personal worth, our human worth. And of course, if I see myself as having no worth, I have very little to offer to God in service. Paul said in verse 3, "To not think of yourself more highly than you ought." Well, there are those that are very proud and you think more highly than they should of themselves. But for the most part, because of the false measure, the false standard of evaluation that we've put on human worth in our society, there is a vast number of people that think less highly of themselves than they ought and see themselves as so little worth that they have very little to offer to God or to those around them. It's a little bit like this fellow here that looks into the mirror. And what he sees in that reflection will determine his whole interpretation of life. It will determine his choices in life. It will determine his choice of a life partner. Because if he has difficulty accepting what he sees in that mirror, he's not going to put a very high price tag on his worth or on his abilities or what he has to offer God in serving God. You see, it depends on our self-image. A person that has, that accepts himself, that appreciates what God has created in himself, he has self-worth. He can accept both his strong points and he can accept his weak points. And he has a certain measure of confidence in what God has given him in abilities to be able to do things. Whereas the person that looks in that mirror and is disappointed with what he sees, disappointed with what he is, he lacks that self-worth. He has difficulty accepting the weaknesses that he sees in his life. He can accept the strong points and he's glad to have them, but oftentimes in his eyes the weaknesses that he sees far outweighs the strong points that he sees. And of course he has he lacks confidence and initiative to put himself into a place where God will use him. So it's the idea that personal worth is not something you're free to take or leave. It's something which we all have to have. And when we don't have it, when we doubt our worth, what God has created, everybody else around us feels it too, because it comes through in our attitudes and our comportment. Now, briefly, I'm going to show you how we've been taught very effectively and efficiently in our society to measure ourselves and measure those around us by false standards. The first one that we're going to look at is the overemphasis that we place on beauty, the price tag that we place on beauty in our society. Now, this we do very effectively, and it starts at a very early age. The winner. And it's very evident because we reward scholarships and everything else. So that the newborn baby, simply by the fact that he's born attractive, he's a good-looking baby. He's got curly hair. He's got ears just the right size. He's got a big winning smile and lovely eyes. One blue, one green, something like this. But he's very attractive. He draws our attention. And so people make a fuss over him. Whereas the other little guy that, like I was for the first year and a half without any hair on his head, who has overly big ears or something like this, or a nose that's about, you know, that big, he knows what it is to be rejected. He knows what it is to be ignored by the adults around him and not to have a fuss made over. And so right at the beginning, we reward those that are born good looking for something that they don't deserve or for something that they had no part in earning. Now we reinforce this as we teach children. We teach the value of beauty by fairy tales. The Ugly Duckling, Sleeping Beauty, Dumbo, the Flying Elephant, Cinderella, all of these. And we see the ridicule and the trouble that those that had physical defects experienced in their lives and experiences because of the fact that others ridiculed them for them. And how you notice all the villains were always disfigured, or the ones that weren't so good-looking, but the heroes were always good-looking. Just like the cowboy, you know, the goodies always had the white horse and the white hat, and the birdies always had the black horse and the black hat. Except Lash LaRue, he was all dressed in black anyway. So we emphasize these things. Then you get up in the first grade and you start giving names, nicknames. They're given in fun, but often they're devastating to self-esteem because that nickname points out the one defect that I'm trying to hide, and I don't want anybody to see it. It's the weakest link in my chain of values. And those things are devastating. To be called Bones, Bucky Beaver, Crow Bait, Frog, Moose, Ozzy Rabbit. Remember who Ozzy Rabbit was? Lee Harvey Oswald. Does that tell you anything? November 23, 1963, when he took aim on President Kennedy there in Dallas, he was taking aim on what to him was a false standard, what to him was the epitome of beauty, success, wealth, renown, because he was one who knew only ridicule all through his life. He joined the Marines to be made a man, but there they ridiculed him as well. His own wife locked him in the bathroom to punish him. And so he had it up to here with that false system, and he rebelled against all society. And he wiped out what to him, the only thing he mastered in life was the marksmanship. So names have a crushing effect. While others laugh, the other suffers. And these are things that we do in fun, unwittingly. So what does this false standard do as it goes on? You get up into a world of secondary education, high school, and there's nothing more important than your appearance. All of that surpasses all other things in importance, that you look good, that you're acceptable to the others. And so this girl, her reflection is true, there's nothing wrong there, but yet she'll have doubts, because she knows perhaps behind that hair lies ears that are sticking out, or that her feet are a size 10 or something like this, you know. And again, she has to do all of her possibility to hide that one defect that she's sure that everybody sees in her. So and what does this do when you get to my age? Well, we try everything to hold back the years. Fading youth, wrinkles, gaining weight, receding hairline, it's all there. And so we spend millions on trying to preserve what we're losing, because we know that youth and beauty, that's where it's at. What does that sort of a system do to our older folk? In a society that's so oriented for youth and for beauty, they feel useless. My mother, 76 years old and blind, would come to visit us once in a while in Quebec, and she'd say one time, she said, "Bill, do you think it's wrong of me that I ask God that I die?" Because she saw herself with so little worth. Here, once she was a woman that had work, she was responsible, she made decisions, she ran her own home. Then she's relegated to a position of a child, where everything's done for her. She has no more part in the decision making, and she's sort of put aside, waiting until she dies. And they say that 80% of the people that suffer from physical maladies in their old age are the direct result of emotional problems. This thing, why do so many older people turn off? It's too hard to bear. The fact that where once they were respected, now they see themselves as useless. And again, these are some of the effects of this emphasis that we put in our society on the high price tag on our appearance, that we look good. Another thing that we emphasize in our society, which is a false standard, which we have to be renewed, have our minds renewed and transformed, is the emphasis that we put on the value of intelligence in society. Just like the young couple with the new baby, well, you know, there's a timetable that baby has to follow if he's going to be normal. And so we regard the baby right from the beginning. You know, we estimate that the baby is normal, but as soon as the baby is born, normal is no longer good enough. He's got to be extraordinary. And so we start looking at he's got to be up on his knees at a certain period of months. He's got to be up on his feet and holding on to something by 9 months. By one year, he's got to be walking unaided, and by 2 years, absolutely, he's got to, he can no longer wet his diapers or anything like that. He's got to be clean. And so there's a timetable that he has to follow, because it's a direct reflection on me. And you see, if my children demonstrate a superior intelligence, I want you all to know that, you see. But if my children demonstrate a less than a normal intelligence, I don't want anybody to know it, because it's a direct reflection on me, you see. And again, this is something that's imposed on us from our society, that that's the way it has to be. And what is this emphasis on being smart? What is the effect of that on the children? Well, they're doing good until they get to first grade. And then they have to sit behind that silly desk and listen to that teacher and do those mental gymnastics, and perhaps they'd rather be out in the street on their tricycle or bicycle. And to do that, they start to realize that there's others that were their friends that are faster. They're smarter. They can understand better, and so you've got the brains here, and everybody knows who the stupid ones are here. And the children, because they don't achieve, they're not as fast as the others, they see themselves, and they're told that they're stupid. And yet there's a lot of other things that enter into that, which have very little to do with intelligence. Why children can have difficulty. Just briefly, reasons other than intelligence why our children may have difficulty learning in school. Here's five categories. And there's more kids that find themselves in those five categories and that see themselves as inferior students than those that actually feel good in a school situation. And what does the child do? Not able to achieve, he feels inferior or stupid. These are some of the things. There's other factors that have an influence on our self-esteem. The way a child thinks that his parents see him, if his parents see him with with respect and with love, with appreciation, or if the child senses that there's disappointment there, that there's a lack of respect. This has a great effect on what the child, how the child sees himself. The attitude of other children in the family. If the other children can fight better, can run better, can lie better, can get out of things, can, you know, all these things have an effect on how he sees himself. Financial difficulties. Our kids up there, we would give our children 10 cents allowance for every year. 8 years old, they get 80 cents a week. 10 years old, they get $1 a week. Yet the little guy 2 doors down the street, he's got $5 in his pocket every Saturday. You know, our kids look at their 80 cents or a dollar and say, I'm poor, you know, inferior. You know, these things, financial difficulties. The fact that the kids go to school, they got only one coat, one pair of boots, and it's a hard time to keep them in socks. Whereas the other kid, he comes and he's got an abundance of everything. Each day he's got something new on. These things can give ideas that I'm inferior to the other. But there's nothing more important in our society than this thing of looking good and being smart. Now that's a false standard. And God says it's a false standard. And Paul says that we Christians should not be conformed to this world or to our society's way of evaluating our worth and our children's worth. So what is the remedy? He says that our minds have to be renewed. And this is what he means by having a new. But there is a better standard for evaluating or measuring a person's value. Now look in the Bible in 1 Samuel 16. 1 Samuel 16, 6 and 7. Here we're going to see that even the prophet of God, Samuel, measured according to society's value system, even as we so often tend to do. You see, Samuel was sent to anoint for God a new king to replace Saul. Saul didn't make out too good as a king, and so God told Samuel to anoint another king to take Saul's place. Then he went to the up to the town where Jesse and his sons lived, and he said, I'm going to have a sacrifice, and I want Jesse and his sons to come to the sacrifice. And then God was going to tell him who the new king was going to be. And then we read in verse 6, and it came to pass that when they were come, that he looked on Eliab, the oldest son, and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before me. He is an impressive looking guy. He's big, he's husky like Saul, handsome. A good warrior of the army of Israel will follow this man. So it must be Eliab who is the Lord's anointed. But the Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance, or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord sees not as a man sees, for the Lord looketh on the outward, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And that's the picture of the matter right there. For a better opinion of yourself, go to God for your opinion rather than to others. Rather than letting other standards determine your worth and looking on the outward appearance. And you know, we do so much according to our outward appearance. The car we buy, the machinery we have in our home, all these things are often sold by first sight. But God says you have to go a little deeper. So what does the Bible say? What does God say is a better standard? How about your appearance? What does the Bible say about your appearance? Look in Psalm 139, 13 through 16. Just two things here that I'd like to show you. Psalm 139, in this passage. Familiar with this passage. This is the meditation of David when he thought about the way God had created him and how he marveled at the handiwork of God. Verse 13, for thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth well. David was thinking about the way that God had created him here. For my substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being imperfect, and in my book all thy members were written, which in continuous were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. David marveled at two things in the way that God had formed him. First off, there's the fact that God was there. He says, For thou hast possessed my veins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. Here it's the idea that you, God, and you alone were there. It's not that God had ordained that he be formed in the mother's womb, but that God is present in David's very creation. And the image there is that just as how many women here do knitting or crocheting? Have you ever watched ladies? I'm amazed at seeing ladies being able to listen to a conversation and talk and things like that, and all the time their hands are going like this, and they're just knitting away without hardly being conscious of what they're doing. And this is the idea that God fashioned with his own hands, as a woman doing knitting, David's body, David's personality, David's makeup, David's frame, his skeletal structure. God was there, personally involved in David's formation. David marveled at that. Verse 14, I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made, marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. This speaks of a place of protection in his mother's womb. And here's the idea that God oversaw David's formation in his mother's womb. Just as an architect who designs a building oversees that building is built according to his plans and specifications, so God was present in David's formation within his mother's womb and oversaw that David's formation, his frame, his appearance, was exactly according to the specifications that he had designed for David's appearance. What does that say? That says that anything about me that is not by hazard, it wasn't a mistake that I have this nose, that I have these ears, that I have this appearance, that I have this height, or this build, but it was by God's design. And each one of us has to look at ourselves and look in that mirror. And so often we have a tendency to be disappointed with what we see. But it wasn't by chance, it was by design, and for a specific reason that we're going to see as we go along, that God chose to make us and to give us this appearance that we have for very specific reasons. We look in 1 Peter 3:3-4, and here, for the lack of time, we're just going to go on. Here Peter says to the ladies and to us in general, not to put so much attention on our outward appearance, what we put on, the way we have our hair, the ornaments that we adorn ourselves with, but rather to put more attention on the hidden man, what we are inside, the hidden man of the heart. These things are of greater value, God says. And then Proverbs 15:13 says that a cheerful heart makes a merry countenance, or a merry heart makes a cheerful countenance, one or the other. And it's the idea that if we put the emphasis, like it says here, if we put the emphasis on the inward man, what we are inside, rather than on our appearance will become a reflection of what we are inside. We'll see it in our attitudes, in our comportment. What we are inside will appear on us, and it will be evident to others too. So it's where we put the accent or the emphasis in our lives. And one of the great examples is the Apostle Paul. Galatians 4:13-15, Paul said, I didn't come to you, I came to you because of a bodily infirmity, because of a sickness that I had. I came to you people to preach the gospel to you for the first time. And he says, interestingly enough, you didn't reject me because of my bodily appearance. You didn't despise my appearance. That means Paul's bodily appearance was one that could be disgusting, that people could despise him for the way he looked. He wasn't an attractive man according to the Bible. And yet they didn't reject him for that. In fact, they accepted him, and they saw him even as an angel of the Lord, as Christ himself. What about Paul's preaching? 1 Corinthians 2, 1-3, it says that, "I was before you in fear and in trembling." So Paul's preaching wasn't all that impressive as far as his eloquence or the words he chose, but he says it was a demonstration of the power of the Spirit of God in him. And so all the things that our society would put value on, appearance, eloquence, the way he delivers himself, all these things, Paul didn't have that. And God chose him yet to deliver that message. And Paul gives us the reason for that. In this verse I want you to look up, 2 Corinthians 4:7. And here Paul gives us the reason why God chose such a vessel to proclaim such a gospel. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. What did I say? 2 Corinthians 4:7. Here it is. He says, "But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us." Why did God choose such an ordinary person as Paul to convey such a great gospel, a gospel that he calls a treasure, its value is so surpassing? Why did he choose such an ordinary man whose bodily appearance was, something that we would despise the way he looked, or we wouldn't be impressed with him in the least? And why did he choose the man who didn't have such great eloquence, but simply a man who could preach the word in trembling and in fear? Because he wanted that to be attributed to God. He wanted the excellency of the power that was evident in Paul's life to be attributable to God and not to Paul. Otherwise, when we would hear Paul speak, we would say, "My, isn't he great? Isn't he a great man? You know, listen to how he speaks. Look at that man. He's got, you know, he's big. He's handsome." And we would attribute it all to man. But God says, "No, I chose an earthen vessel, not a silver vessel, not a brass vessel, not a gold vessel, but a clay pot. And I put this great treasure in that clay pot in order that people would marvel at what I've done in that life." And so that's the same thing with us, our appearance. God gave me these ears. God gave me this nose. God gave me this mouth, this height, this build. Because he said that the message that I was going to communicate and put in you, in that clay vessel, is going to demonstrate the power of God in your life. And each one of us can look at our frame, look at our appearance, and know that God gave us that to accentuate, complement the message that he's committed to each one of us, the gospel of Jesus Christ and the transformed life. Because 16 years ago, when I sat in a Christian meeting for the first time in Jacksonville, Florida, there was a 23-year-old Bible student that was preaching that day. Not very impressive looking. Not a very impressive preacher. But you know what struck me? How ordinary the guy was. How simply ordinary he was. And yet I saw that he had something that I didn't have. I didn't communicate in his speech, didn't communicate in his appearance, but I knew it was there. And I said, if God can do that to him, I don't know what he can do with me. And I came to Christ 6 months later through meeting very ordinary people whose lives had been transformed and demonstrated the power of God in their life. And so God chooses very ordinary vessels to communicate a treasure. And we are monuments. Ephesians chapter 1, verses 6, verses 12, and verses 14 says that all of redemption is to the praise of his glory. All that God has done in redeeming us is for one reason: to demonstrate, to praise his glory. So every Christian is as a monument. We go to a monument and we admire a monument. And that monument commemorates something. And God's work in our lives is a monument to his grace, so that all other ordinary people can look at us, you Christians, and see what God has done in your lives. That's why God has given you an appearance the way you have, to communicate a message. Now, if we put too much accent on that appearance, what does it do? Well, it takes away. It takes away the attention from that which it's supposed to accentuate, the message of the beautiful flower. But God doesn't want us either to neglect our appearance, to have a shabby appearance, because that's a bad testimony for the Lord Jesus too, who is a beautiful person. But God says, no, get it straight. Not to overemphasize our bodily appearance, nor to neglect our bodily appearance, but that it would accentuate the message of Jesus Christ in us, that we've transformed people. Now, in closing, we're going to look at just two other things, very briefly, in the 3 minutes that we have. What does the Bible then say about your abilities? The false standard says that only the winners, only the beautiful, or only the super intelligent are of real worth. And we put these people in our society up on a pedestal and say, that's our model. Unconsciously, that's what we do. Look in Matthew 25:13-23. Let's begin with verse 14. He says, "For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent. To every man," and anywhere on this in your Bible, "every man according to his several ability." And straightway he took his journey. But the key to this whole thing is the fact that he gave to each one of his servants talents according to each one's capacity or ability. The principle is that before God, those with less ability are just as appreciated as those with much ability. Because if you look in verse 20, well, we know that these servants, he took his journey, and then he came back and he had an accounting with his servants. In verse 20, "So he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou hast delivered unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside then 5 talents more. Now listen to the reward that he got. And his Lord said unto him, Well done, thou good and faithful servant, thou hast been faithful over a few things, I will make thee ruler over many things, enter thou into the joy of thy Lord." And it's interesting that the servant that had only 2 talents and used those 2 talents, what reward did he get? He got exactly, word for word, the same reward as the servant that had 5 talents. And I tell you that the guy that had received, the servant that had 1 talent, had he abused that 1 talent, he would have gotten exactly the same reward. Because God's not interested in our talents. He's not interested in the fact that I can stand here and do one thing and another brother can sit there and do another thing. He's not impressed. Because God's not interested in our talents. He's interested in our responsibility, in our loyalty, in our faithfulness. Is that the word I'm looking for? Yeah, faithfulness. What we do with those talents. Because the man with 5 talents, he used those 5 talents, that's all. And God rewarded him for his faithfulness. The man with 2 talents, he used those 2 talents. And God rewarded him exactly as he rewarded the man with a lot of talents. And if that man had the 1 talent, if he had used that single talent he had, God would have rewarded him for that talent. Now, that's not society's measure. Society puts the accent on the talents. And we reward people that have a lot of talent. And it's very easy for us in an assembly of Christians to reward those, to look upon those with a lot of talent and say, gee, I wish there was like them. That's not where it's at. God says, no, be faithful with the 1 talent you have. Don't dig a hole and put it in there and try to preserve it, because if you try to preserve it, you're going to lose it, the parable says. And he says, take that 1 talent, if it's gathering books, if it's shaking hands, if it's sweeping the floor, if it's pushing the vacuum cleaner, or whatever it is, use the talent for the Lord, and God says, I'm going to multiply that and give you other responsibilities. If you demonstrate that you're faithful with the little thing you can do for me, I'll multiply it. The man with five, give him five others. The man with two, give him two others. The man with one, he would have had another. And so this is the thing. Let's not regard or see those that it's only the winners, the beautiful, the most intelligent, or the most talented, and envy those people, but rather be faithful with the little thing that God has given us, the little capacity, ability that God has given us. Faithful with that, and God will multiply it, and He'll reward us for that. Now, what does the Bible say, lastly, about your personal value, your personal worth? Luke 12, 6 and 7 is the story of the birds, and he says that a sparrow, you know, doesn't fall, but he's not aware of it. And it's also about the hairs on your head. You know, you lose on an average about 75 hairs a day. Do you know that? Some of us a few more, some of us a few less. Some a lot more. So, anyway, that's the idea. But it's not that God simply knows how many hairs we lost each day, but He knows which one. Which hairs? He knows that it was 1,732, 1,964. Which ones fall? It's the idea that our hairs aren't simply counted, they're enumerated, remembered. That's how well God knows us. 1 Peter 1:18-19, Peter says, you were not purchased, you were not redeemed with corruptible things such as silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ. That's the price tag that God has put on us. And it's often been said that if I were the only sinner, if you were the only sinner on earth, Christ would have given Himself to redeem you nonetheless. That's the value that God puts on. 1 Corinthians 6:20a says, for it was a great price. It has been with a great price that we have been redeemed. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which belong to God. What does that say? That means that Christ has paid the highest price to make us His own. His death for us demonstrates the high value that God has put on each one of us. That's what makes the gospel so beautiful, isn't it? The fact that God could look on me, a solitary person, and be interested in me and accept me as I am. So much so that Christ came to die, not for the world, He came to die for me. He came to die for you. That's the beauty of the gospel. The Lord looks at individuals and says, I love you right where you are, and I want you to be mine. Again, our verse, Romans chapter 12, verse 2, do not be conformed to this world. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold of evaluating your personal worth, your children's worth, by a false standard of beauty or intelligence or wealth or whatever it might be. But be renewed in your minds. Have your minds transformed by looking into this book and seeing what God says about your bodily appearance, that He chose you just as you are to communicate treasure of what He can do in your life to transform you. And what does He say? Be faithful with the abilities, the talents that I've given you. Don't be so impressed with those with a lot. But be faithful with the little bit that I've given you. And He'll multiply it and use it to His glory. And then that He's put a high price tag on you. Now tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to look at some things we can do to help ourselves, to help our children develop a better opinion of themselves, that when they look into that mirror, they can accept what God has done. They can accept who they are, and they can have something to set offer to God as a living sacrifice for His service. We're going to talk on the area of communications in our home. We're going to look at the area of discipline in our homes, how to give our children compensating tools to gain the acceptation and the recognition that they need so much. We're going to look a little bit at discipline. We're going to look a little bit at rebellion and these things. How to teach children responsibilities. And how we can help our children develop a better opinion of themselves. And oftentimes in looking at that, we're going to understand ourselves a little better and why we feel the way we do about ourselves. Let's commit ourselves to the Lord and thank Him for what He's done in our lives.